The 1967 Monterey Pop Festival was the first big outdoor epic rock festival. The concert was the predecessor of Woodstock, and the film Monterey Pop set the tone for subsequent concert films. Monterey Pop is one of the many films directed by my guest Don Pennebaker. Along with Robert Drew, Richard Laycock, and the Maisels brothers, he created the documentary form known as cinema verite, or direct cinema. These were documentary films that used no scripting, no narration, and no staged scenes. The filmmakers tried to have no effect on their subjects other than to record their actions. Pennebaker worked on groundbreaking films, using this form to examine the primary race between John Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey, and the confrontation over school desegregation between the Kennedy administration and Governor George Wallace. But Pennebaker is best known for his music documentaries, which include Don't Look Back, a film about Bob Dylan's first tour of England, and Bowie, about David Bowie's final concert in his Ziggy Stardust character. Pennebaker has a new film about the British electropop band Depeche Mode. Next week, two of Pennebaker's new films will open in New York at the Film Forum. Jimmy Plays Monterey and Shake are concert films featuring previously unreleased footage of Jimi Hendrix and Otis Redding at the Monterey Pop Festival. I asked Pennebaker why he wanted to produce this footage into new films.
It wasn't a very heavy decision. We've had that stuff sitting there along with somewhere over a million feet of stuff that that I've been filming and other people with me have been filming over the last 25 years. And some of it are films we've never even edited or tried to release. There was just no particular demand for them. So it sits there kind of accusingly. And in the case of the Jimmy stuff, Alan Douglas, who represents the Hendrix estate for his father, and whoever else is involved, I don't know, came to us and said, listen, you're sitting on all this stuff. It's the best stuff of Jimmy playing, and it's crazy to have it just sit there. Would you make a film? And I said, well, we'd like to, but it's kind of expensive. So he said, well, I'll put up the money if you make the film, and then we'll split it. So we did that, and in the course of doing it, we got into the Otis Redding and made a short of that, eventually expanding that for an HBO show. And then that kind of led us into the Yoko, the John and Yoko piece at Toronto, which we also did for HBO.
Mm-hmm.
All of them eventually, of course, they're all going into video. That's our plan, is to, I've got something like 30 or 40 films that I want to get into video form in the next year or two, and get some kind of a library together, because that's the main way to distribute, I think, in the coming generation.
The meaning of the footage that you're using in these new films has really changed, in the sense that Jimi Hendrix is dead, Otis Redding is dead, John Lennon is dead. And so this stuff not only has important archival value, but it's become very important footage because it's some of the best footage that we have of these performers that's ever been recorded. What kind of lesson does that offer to you about the importance of shooting people in action in their time?
Well, it's something I must say I've always absolutely known, but it's really hard to get anyone in a responsible position to deal with it seriously at any level, either in the television itself, on the part of management of whoever it is that you're filming, and sometimes even the performers. I wanted to do a film on Chris Everett so badly for years, and I went to her agent, and she thought about it and finally said, no, I just wish I were filming today, because she's really an interesting person. I think she's the most interesting person in tennis, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to be able to make a film about her, so it's frustrating.
When you look back at how you shot the Monterey Pop film, what do you think you'd do differently now from then?
Not much. I'd probably do it the same way, no directing. I'd get people that I really liked, and I'd let them go their own way. I mean, whose work I liked and who I knew were filmmakers, and let them figure it out themselves. I think that's the strongest way you can film. And in fact, when we were doing the Depeche Mode film, we operated just almost exactly the same as at Monterey.
Mm-hmm. When you say no directing, do you think that many music documentaries have directing in it? Concert films.
Yeah, I think... Well, what you're dealing with is a concept of management. It's like, in a sense, management had a hard time with film, because in the end, there was one eye behind the camera. And that was usually, if not an artist, somebody that looked like one. And in the end, you had to depend on what he saw and did. He pulled the trigger. I'm not saying that the cameraman necessarily is the camera operator, but somewhere down the line, there's a camera operator that everybody has to trust and go along with. It's hard to look over his shoulder. Now you have video assists. Now there's 26 people in a booth watching every move he makes. He doesn't count for much anymore. I mean, he could be replaced with some kind of a robot. And I think television in general picked up that concept, and it's why television appeals to management more than filmmaking, because in a sense the guy in the booth is always management.
Where were you during Monterey Pop? Were you behind one of the cameras?
I was on stage most of the time, partly because Bob Neuwirth, who kind of represented our stage direction, if there was such a thing, that is, he had a red light that he could turn on and off. And the red light meant that when the red light was on, all the filmmakers were encouraged to film if they had film in their cameras or could see anything. It didn't mean they necessarily had to, and in fact, if it weren't on, they could still shoot. There were no rules that strongly. But when someone like Hendrix or Otis came on, even though our general strategy was to shoot one song of each performer, because there were so many performers and we would have run out of film somewhere early in the game if we just shot our whims away. But that each performer, when he came up, Bob would kind of decide which song, and I would sort of be there to kind of just to hear myself what we were doing. I would pretty much let him be the judge of what to do. But in somebody like the minute Hendrix started to play, we were all, I was somewhat bemused because Hendrix walked out on stage chewing gum. It looked like he was chewing gum. And totally disconnected, and it did not seem to me. I mean, I didn't know much about him. I'd heard that he set himself on fire, which didn't seem to me a very heavy musical aspiration. But we kind of watched, and I think somewhere about 3 seconds into the first song, Neuwirth and I I just looked over there, and the red light was on, and it never went off. And in a way, that's as much directing as I guess I ever did, was to just to be where I knew certain decisions would be made. And then I filmed from that. I could film audience from the stage, and I can film performers.
Let's talk a little bit about Don't Look Back, your movie about Bob Dylan, about his British tour in 1965. Now, I believe that you did this film because Albert Grossman, who was Dylan's manager at the time, suggested that you accompany them on the tour and shoot the movie. What kind of agreement, if any, did you have about what you'd be allowed to shoot and what would remain off camera?
There was no agreement or arrangement. It was really just a handshake. And I think that that's fair enough. I think that although there was nothing on paper, I think there was a kind of conceptual, a gravitational rule that held, and that I could do almost anything I wanted, but I had to be prepared that if in some way I did something, and I'm not sure what it would have been, that in fact was really lame or that didn't appeal to everyone, that the entire thing could collapse instantly. In other words, I was there under a kind of peculiar rule that was only understood, but it was never actually laid out. And I think to this day, neither Dylan and I have any idea what it really consisted of. But it was a real kind of force that controlled what we both did.
Well, it's a fascinating film to look at, especially from the vantage point of over 20 years later. And one of the things that's so interesting is that you see Dylan outside of the performance mode, and he actually comes off as pretty arrogant in a lot of the movie. And I want to play a brief clip from the film.
Okay.
And this is an encounter that he had with a reporter from Time magazine. The reporter wanted to do a story on him, and Dylan's explaining that he really has no interest in Time or this reporter.
Are you going to see the concert tonight?
Yes.
Are you going to hear it?
No.
Okay, you hear and see it, and it's going to happen fast. And you're not going to get it all. And you might even hear the wrong words, you know. And then afterwards, see, I won't be able to talk to you afterwards. I got nothing to say about these things I write. I mean, I just write them. I don't need to say anything about them. I don't write them for any reason. There's no great message. I mean, if you know, you want to tell other people that, go ahead and tell them. But I'm not going to have to answer to it. And they're just going to think, you know, what's this Time magazine telling us? But you couldn't care less about that either. You don't know the people that read you. Because, you know, I've never been in Time magazine, and yet this hall is filled twice. You know, and I've never been in Time magazine. I don't need Time magazine. And I don't think I'm a folk singer. You'll probably call me a folk singer. But, you know, the other people know better. Because the people that, you know, that buy my records listen to me don't necessarily read Time magazine.
Well, that's Bob Dylan talking to the reporter from Time. Now, he might be very right about how the Time magazine reporter would have totally misinterpreted what was happening, but he treats him with real contempt in that scene that we were hearing. Did he ever regret, do you think, being captured in that way on camera?
Well, I don't know. Dylan's very mercurial. What he feels in the morning, he may well not feel by the afternoon. And I know that there's some things in that movie because he's been after me for years to take them out. That's not one of them. You see him as being overbearing and, in a sense, making use of his peremptorial position to put down the Time writer, whom I knew. But in the end, he kind of laid back off him in a way that I thought was very... I think he took the curse out of the thing, and I think that the reporter felt that. It was a strange... It's a way that Dylan had of coming down and being extremely abusive, and then just almost as if by comparison of pulling back, and the person felt like it was really not aimed at him. It was aimed at something else and had missed him. And felt kind of a sense of relief. And I think that that's... I know because I read his story that he filed. I have a copy of it, in fact. And it has absolutely in it no vindictiveness toward Dylan.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask which scenes Dylan wanted to take out of the film?
The haranguing in the hotel room with everybody screaming and yelling. And the about the glass being thrown out the window. And it's just because he hated the idea of being seen in that kind of a situation, I guess. I don't know. See, I don't think he had the slightest idea of how that film would look when we began. And what he wanted to do, in a way, he hoped to get something out of it, too. He wanted to find out if you could make a movie by yourself, because that's the way he did music. That's the way he did everything. And he didn't want to go to Warner Brothers and be cast in the Bob Dylan film the way, Elvis had. So... he was looking at to see if there was some other option. And I'm not sure, you know, that that's the movie he would have made. But in the end, he recognized that it was a movie. He was enough of a dramatist, enough of a whatever it is that looks at movies, to see that it did work, that it would catch an audience interest, and it was about him in some way. But it's the same time he felt ripped off, as you would, or anyone would, in that his life had sort of been used without his total permission. But that's what's required. That's why it's hard to make. So I don't, you know, again, I'm not trying to explain anything. I feel in the movie all I can do is to sit in a corner of a room and show you what it would be like if you were sitting in the corner of the room. And I don't really have much advantage over you. I don't know anything you don't know.
Filmmaker Don Pinnebaker is my guest, and his movies include Monterey Pop and Don't Look Back, which is a documentary about Bob Dylan. You have a new film now about Depeche Mode, which is a British electro-pop band. I wonder what it was like for you to do that movie in the sense that I don't know how much they mean to you in the same way that some of the performers at Monterey Pop or Bob Dylan might have meant something to you.
You mean, and now after the film or before the film?
Well, before the film, when you decided to take it on. Their following is mostly teenagers, which you're not anymore.
Well, I'm not. I don't have to be a critic. See, that's the advantage of being a filmmaker. I mean, there's some things you have to be. But I don't have to know what the best music is and, in a sense, present it. I'm not a presenter either. I'm following my nose, and I'm trying to find where a film might be, where something interesting is going on. And I guess something told me that they were ripe for it, and I don't know what it is, and I may never know. But in the end, I know that I did the right thing because it was such a fantastic thing to do, and we all felt that. It was the most marvelous adventure, and I have the most total respect for those guys, even though you're right, they're a world away from me. We practically can't speak across that generation void. But at the same time, they're fearless. And I really love anybody that's fearless. They go at their concerts the way we go at our filming, and they don't give a damn how we do it. If we want to get out there with handheld cameras walking around the stage, that's our business. And they had no eyes to change that. And I felt that that was terrific, that very few people would give us that reckless abandonment, as it were.
One of the documentary filmmakers you started working with was Robert Drew, and he once said that he wanted to find a new form of documentary because he found himself watching documentaries on TV, subjects that he thought he should be interested in, that he was interested in, and he'd fall asleep, and he figured something's wrong with the way documentaries were being shot. This was in the 1960s, early 1960s. What were your reasons for wanting to find new ways of making documentary films?
Well, I would like the film to be like the novel, a work of one person's imagination with whatever help he needs and can get, but not the work of a company whose business is investment.
But as far as the form, what did you think needed fixing?
Well, I think it was too dead. It's like the lighting in most Hollywood films. It all looks like the magazine stories in Architectural Digest, where nobody lives in the rooms. There's no throw up on the floor. There's no baby pissing in a corner. It's all kind of a dead world, and I think movies reflect that. And it's a fake world. It has no grain in it. It has no life in it.
When you first started making documentaries, it was essential to have camera equipment that made it possible to follow people around and to be as unintrusive as possible. I think you contributed a lot to redesigning camera equipment to make it more portable.
Well, we had to. In World War II, which was supposedly the war about which all the movies were being made, the only cameras were 35-millimeter hand-wound cameras that would run about 18 seconds, the IMOs, the Bell and Howell IMO. And that meant that in the end, almost all the films that you'll ever see about World War II are fake films. Any cannon looks like the cannon you need. Any bomb bursting is the bomb you need. So in a way, it's put together like Hollywood movies are. There's very little continuity of reality, except for one film, which was made on a carrier. And that they made with 16-millimeter. They were able to use long runs, 400-foot rolls, so they could have 10-minute runs. And while it has no sound, it has the realest feeling you ever saw in a movie of that period, and it stuns you. And it hit me when I saw that film that that's the way real life could be recorded, with long runs. But you had to get out of the studio. You had to get away from things to plug in. You had to find ways of getting sync sound in a desert or in an opera or any place interchangeably. You couldn't have a special solution for each movie. You had to have a general solution for anything you decided to do that morning.
So you designed what to make this more possible?
Well, we designed a camera that you could hold on your shoulder and only ran, mine eventually ran less than 2 or 3 watts to run. It's still less than most cameras that you can buy. And you could look through it, you could turn it on, it would lock into sync. So when you played it back, it would play back in real time. And we did work on many aspects, lights, the Nagras. We worked with Kedelsky on the Nagra to develop something that was also portable. I think in the beginning, we put clocks on everything. We had clock cameras and clock recorders because we were using the Bulova Accutron watch, which was fairly accurate. And by using that to trigger the motor in the camera and the motor on the tape, or record a single tape, we were able to lock them together and make them sync up.
We only have about a minute left, so I'll ask you this quickly. There must be a moment in your career when you think back and think to yourself, why wasn't the camera running when that happened?
No, because if you get that way, you can get suicidal. Because you keep wanting to have people go back and come through the door again or do something or say something that just seemed to you fantastic. And you just learned to not listen to that voice, to let it happen, because sooner or later what you know is that people will do everything over and over again. They always do it over and over again. And they know what they know what they're doing. They're watching you. They're watching you as much as you're watching them. And they want you to get their lives. They really want you to do it. It worked with Kennedy that way. It's worked with, I mean, Kennedy had to sneak us in the back of the White House because he wanted us to make that film. And it happens over and over again. So you begin to not worry about that. That's the wrong thing to worry about. You worry about, I don't know what, you worry about everything. You worry about whether you have enough film and you're going to get it processed. And, but you don't worry about what you don't get, because in the end, you know you're going to miss 90% anyhow. I mean, movies are made with 10% of what happened. But that's better than 0%, which is what generally people get.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your movies.
Okay.
Documentary